All right, we're getting in here on the top of Kuf Dalet Amud Aleph by the two dots. It says in the Mishnah, Lo Yitein Lo Livno V'lo Lishtucho. It says that when the person wants to return the money to the person that he had denied owing the money and taking a Shvuah, that he has to ensure that the money reaches him directly. And then he shouldn't send it with his son or with his Shliach. There we saw in the Mishnah the reason being that he's not deemed to have returned it until it reaches the individual himself. That means that anything that happens to that money along the way, he still will be responsible for it. Now, Itmar, Shliach Shasau Be'edim. A Shliach who was appointed through Edim, meaning that there were witnesses to the fact that this individual appointed the Shliach. Bufchistamar Havish Shliach. That is a good Shliach, meaning that, as Rashi notes over here, if this agent comes to collect on behalf of whomever, it is deemed to be as if you've returned the money to the person that you owe it. So if this is a debtor trying to return the money to the creditor, if he hands it over to the creditor, shliach, it's as if he handed it to the creditor himself, and he's acting or functioning in place of the creditor. And the same in any scenario where someone owes money. Rabba amar, lo avi shliach. Rabba says that's not enough to make him into a shliach, as Rashi notes over here, that is for onsin baderech. Meaning that if something happens along the way, then the individual who handed the money will be responsible because the money has yet to reach the destination or the party to whom it is supposed to get. Now Tosfot over here already discusses within Rabba's position, what does that mean? Lo have shliach. I mean, how do you establish a proxy? How do you establish an agent? Here, if you did it in front of Edim, isn't that sufficient? So Tosfot over here has two requirements. The first of which is, if the individual says that I want you to send it with him. It says, Shalach li al yado. Send the money back through this proxy. Send the money back through this agent. That will make him into an agent that will function in a way that he is responsible. But number two, Tosafot brings an additional qualification which will persist throughout the sugya. Tosafot will keep utilizing this, which is it has to be bifanav. It has to be in front of the debtor. Which means that the creditor appoints an agent, says, send the money back with this individual. It's not enough that he appointed the shliach in that manner. He has to do it in front of the debtor. So the debtor hears him say, give it to this shliach, or you can send it back through this shliach. So those are the two requirements. Number one is that he appoints a shliach to collect. And the second of which is that the debtor is not just aware through a deem of that fact, but that it was done in front of the debtor. The debtor is aware of the fact that this shliach works. When he tells it in front of him, it has to be done while the debtor is present. So those are the two qualifications according to Rabba in order for him to be a shliach. When he is done through a deem in absence of the debtor, then he's not a shliach. I mean, he will be an agent to bring the money back. He just won't have the responsibility for the money, or it's not as if the money was returned to the creditor until it reaches the creditor itself. So Rav Chisda Maravi Shliach, Ahachi Tarchi Be'ukmei Be'edim. The reason he's a shliach is because that's why he went through all the trouble to set up this agent with Edim, to leku birshutei, so that it would be in his possession. Rav amar lo bishliach, hachika amar. This is what he's saying. Inish mehemnehu. This guy is trustworthy. Isamach samuch. If you want to rely on him, that's fine. Ibayit l'shturi biyodei, shadar biyodei. If you want to send it in his hands, then send it in his hands. Now what's interesting about this, Tosafot points this out, which is that generally the problem with giving over money to another party is that we have a principle, shomer shemasa l'shomer. When something is placed in your trust, and then you hand it over to another party in their trust, the original owner, or the original person can say to you, it's fine that you did that, but I just don't trust the second person. He can say, in mitzoni shiyeh piktoni b'yadacher. I have no interest in my pikadon, my deposit being with someone else. Or you can say to him, I don't trust him to take a shvu'ah. In this case, all of that goes away. Because the individual, when he sent him, according to Rabba, said, this guy is trustworthy. This guy is a good guy. So all of those claims go away. And why can't this just be a case of shomer shemaser the shomer? Which is that, yes, the debtor is a shomer in a sense. He hands over the item to the shliach. That new shliach becomes a shomer. And as far as the creditor is concerned, that shomer is trustworthy, and he can't say, I don't want my item to be with him. He already declared that he is willing to accept it. So then why is there a failure in the transference over here? So what he says is that it's a case or a scenario where they have to traverse a dangerous area. And therefore, even if he gave the money back to the original creditor, it would have still been a problem for the debtor. The debtor owes the money to the creditor. He has to make the money available where the creditor gave him the money. That's at the creditor's home or in the creditor's city. If between where the debtor is and the creditor, there's dangerous roads or difficult areas to traverse, then even if he gave it back to the creditor in the debtor's possession where he is, it would still not be deemed as given back to the creditor because he hasn't done what he's supposed to do, which is provide the creditor the money in a safe and returned way. And since there's danger in the way, even if he gives over to another shomer, even if he gave it to the creditor himself, it would not be considered returned until the creditor reaches his house. And so because of that, you can't deem this shomer shemasa the shomer or say that there is a certain amount of trust here in the shomer, because that's not the issue. The issue is he has an obligation to make sure the money gets back to the creditor in a safe manner or in the same way that he received the money. That means he received it in the creditor's city. He's got to return it there. If there's danger lurking between him and that city, then that danger makes it that there's a problem from getting it from the debtor to the creditor. And over to overcome that problem, you have to then ensure that it gets to him. Forget about Shomer Shemasta Somer. This is the responsibility of the debtor to get it to him. Okay, so Tanan, it's interesting, the Gemara now asks the question. Tosafot just says, an aside, makes a hara, that the Gemara asks from this Mishnah first and not from our Mishnah. The second question is going to come from our Mishnah. He says he doesn't really understand why our Mishnah was not the first question, and he doesn't understand why Rav Chista's statement, which we're going to see now, which is derived from our Mishnah, was also not brought first. So he just makes that as a side hara. We'll see that as it's coming along. It doesn't make a difference to the technicals of the sugya, just something that he notes, that it seems a little strange, the order of the Gemara. But it's not. No, shu'elet apara, person who borrows a cow, b'shilcha b'yad b'no, b'yad abdo, b'yad shlucho, o b'yad b'no, b'yad abdo, b'yad shlucho, shel shoel. The mash'il, the lender, is sending the para over to the borrower's house. So either sent it with his own son, his own eved, his own proxy, or he sent it in the hands of the son of the borrower, the eved of the borrower, or the proxy of the borrower. Umeta, and it dies on the way there. Patur, the shoel is patur. Now, in terms of a shoel is chayav in everything, even on sim. A shoel is on the hook for anything that happens to the animal, with the exception of meta machmat melacha, because that's why he borrowed the item, is in order to utilize it. With that exception, he's chayav for anything. Yet, over here, he is patur. So what you see here is the fact that there are shlichim over here does not overcome the problem of the obligation. Here, the shoel, the borrower, sent a proxy to go pick up the animal. Yet, we say that the animal is not deemed to be in his possession until it reaches him himself, because if it dies on the way, it's still the mash'il, it's the lender's problem. So now, Gemara says, Hai shlucho, hei chidami. What exactly is the shliach that was created over here? If the shoel, the borrower, established some sort of agent to bring it back to him, how was this agency established? Idelo asa be'edim. If he didn't do it with edim, minayadinan. Then how do we know that he's an agent? An agent only is an agent because, first of all, he didn't do it in front of the mashiach. He did it and he sent the agent over there. Now that he sent the agent over there, how do we know that that agent really is a representative of the shoel? The answer is edim. We have witnesses that establish the fact that he is an agent. So that means that the agent is coming with no evidence of the fact that he's an agent. How do we know? He has edim to that fact. Well, that's our case here. Shliach shasel be'edim. Yet what you see here is that the responsibility does not shift to the shoel until it reaches him. That's against Rav Chista's position that a shliach becomes a shliach la'unsin once you've established him with edim. Ella, dasau be'edim, viktani de patur. It says it's patur kasha l'Rav Chista. That's a problem for Rav Chista. Kida'ama Rav Chista. Rav Chista answers, no, the agency was not created here through edim, rather b'schiro v'likito, which is that the agency was self-evident. So he sent someone who has a connection to the shoel. The shoel sent one of his day laborers to pick it up. He sent a likito. Rashi over here gives two shatim about what a likito is. One is this is a guy who basically boards with the owner. He eats on his shulchan. Seems like he's taking care of him or Rashi calls it Tzavta Ba'alma, for company. In the first instance is that he keeps him there, he eats with him, he's just a good friend, and he wants him around for the companionship, so he takes care of him to have this companion around. The other second pshat, Rashi says, Likito, is that he's someone who works in the field, collecting in the field. So he works in the field, but he gets paid by picking and taking stuff from the field while he's working in the field. But either way, these are people who are associated with the Shoel, and therefore the default status of Shlichut is established here, not through Edim, but just by the fact that they are associated with the Shoel. So then it's no longer a question for Rav Chisda, because the agency was not created through Edim over here. So Hachanami, so too in our case, it's B'schiro B'kli Kito, and this is Tosavot's question, Tanan, our Mishnah. Lo Yitein Lo Livno V'lo Lishlucho. In our Mishnah it says, dude, you don't give it over to the son of the Nigzal or the Shliach of the Nigzal. Hai Shlucho Hechidami. Again, the agency that was created here, how did the Nigzal create the agency? All we have is an agent standing in front of him now. We have no idea that he is or how he is an agent. So Igalo Asa Obeidim. If he didn't do what they deem, minayadina, how do we know that he is the shliach, or that he's established this agency over here? The way Rashi's phrasing it is, because in our sugya, it's not just that we want to know that he's an agent. We want to know that he's an agent that has full responsibility once he's taken the item, that it's deemed as if given back at that point.
Maybe.
So again, Beno is easy to understand why the Beno is, you would give it over to the son.
Right.
Because he's the son of this individual. But that doesn't mean he accepts responsibility until it reaches him. The Shoel has to explicitly accept responsibility for that, meaning that the Mashil sending it with his son, but that doesn't mean that the Shoel accepts responsibility until it reaches him, because we have no evidence of that fact. Ella, lav daso be'edim. It must be a scenario where he pointed the agency through Edim. And again, that would be a problem for Rav Chisda, because then you have a Shliach that is appointed through Edim yet, it's not deemed as to be reaching the Nigzal until it actually gets to the hands of the Nigzal. Again, Targum Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda explained our Mishnah, B'schiro v'lekito. So here you see is the core statement of Rav Chisda. And so that's what Tosafot says. I don't understand why they didn't just bring this Mishnah first, and then establish Rav Chisda's principle, and then bring the second Mishnah and say Rav Chisda answers the same way. They first answer this case where Rav Chisda extrapolated to that case the same din, and then they come back and talk about the Mikor. So here's the Mekor where he says, Chiro v'lekito, so that's how we know. It wasn't a case where there was an agency appointed by Edim, it was self-evident agency, but again, not agency through Edim, which would put him on the hook for the Onsim until it reaches him. He just sent the Mashliach. We know he's a representative of this individual, but it doesn't mean that this individual is willing to accept the money to be as if given back once you hand it over to that Shliach. Aval, Shliach shaso be'edim, mai. But if he did establish a shliach with edim according to Rav Chisda, what would be the din? Hachanami davi shliach. Then ain't no chanami, he would be a shliach. Adatoni seifa. Then instead in the seifa of writing the case where the shliach is deemed to take responsibility. Remember in our Mishnah, the case is if he hands it over to his son or the shliach of the nigzal, the gazlan is not discharged his obligation until it reaches the nigzal. On the other hand, the Mishnah says if he hands it over to shliach beitin, he's discharged his obligation right away. So that's the contrasting case, is a case of Shliach Beit Din. But why don't you make the contrasting case, instead of being, well, the case where it doesn't work is when it's Likito and Tzchiro. The case where it does work is when he appointed the Shliach with Edim. According to Rav Chisda, that would be the contrasting case. The Tani Seifa, Menoteinu is Shliach Beit Din, Liflog V'nitnei B'didei. Let him make a finer distinction within the situation of Shliach, of agency itself. Shliach, She'osau B'med V'im Amurim, this is in the Bach. B'shliach shelo asau be'edim. But the shliach who, he didn't do with edim. Ava shliach shasau be'edim, hachanami davi shliach. That would be a simple way to differentiate in the Mishnah between a shliach that does work and a shliach that doesn't work. It's amre lo psikale. There it's not definitive. It's not a clear cut halacha. Shliach be'edim, in the case of a shliach be'edim, lo shna asau nigzal, velo shna asau gazlan. It doesn't matter who you made the shliach or created the agency here, whether it was the gazlan, the thief himself, or the nigzal, the one who was stolen from. As long as they appointed a shliach beitin, have a shliach. He is considered to be a shliach, no matter who is the principal behind this agent. And psikale. Therefore, you can say for certain, shliach beitin, if you give it to the shliach beitin, you're done. You've discharged your obligation, no matter who created the shliach beitin. Shliach shaso beitim. If it's a shliach that was appointed, an agent that was created through Edim, t'chiasau nigzal hu davi shliach. If it was the person who was stolen from that appointed this agent, then that's an agent that is as if accepted, or the whole deal is done once he reaches it. Asel Gazlan, on the other hand, if the Gazlan makes this the agent, lo avishliach, then he doesn't become a shliach, then he is. He's a proxy of the Gazlan. He's not a proxy of the Nigzal, and therefore he still would not have discharged his obligation until it reaches the Nigzal. Lo psikale, therefore it's not a definitive statement. You can't just say, shliach shesel edim, you're done. That's not true. It depends who appointed the shliach through edim. By shliach beitin, you can say you're done no matter who appointed the shliach. And therefore, that's why the Mishnah used that as the contrasting case, because it is clearly defined and it's a straightforward binary halacha. It's yes, and then if you didn't do it, it's no. Lufuke mehai tana. And it comes to exclude or argue on this tana with the tanya, Rabbi Shimon Elazar Omer, shliach beitin, sha'asau nigzal. A shliach beitin that's appointed by the person who was stolen from. Veloso Gazlan, and the Gazlan wasn't involved in the appointment at all. Oh, Asau Gazlan, or the Gazlan made the Shliach Beitin into the Shliach, Vishalach Hala, Benata Lechelo. And then the Nigzal, the person who was stolen from, sends someone to meet the Shliach Beitin and takes it into his possession, Lechelo Miyado, he takes it out of the hand of Shliach Beitin, Patur. So here you see from Shimon Elazar, the ways that you are Patur are the following. The Shliach Beitin was appointed by the Nigzal, but the person was stolen from, then if you hand it to the Shliach Beitin, you've discharged your obligation, you're done. Yeah. Or, if the Gazlan appoints the Shliach Beitin, and the person it was stolen from now accepts it, or receives it from that Shliach Beitin, then you're done. But unless he's taken it or received it from the Shliach Beitin, then you're not done. That shows you, or basically what the argument is here is, when the Gazlan appoints a Shliach Beitin, does it work? According to our Mishnah, the answer is yes. According to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, when the Gazlan appoints a Shliach Beitin, it's no different than him appointing a regular Shliach. And the Gazlan's on the hook till it reaches the hands of the Nigzal. Right. So it's not clear whether that means that Beitin appoints the Shliach, and then the person who needs the Shliach doesn't have to compensate because he's a Shliach Beitin. Maybe the Shliach Beitin was heading there anyway, and so Beitin just has him take this along. Or is there a monetary requirement for the person to reimburse the Beitin for the fact that they're sending a Shliach Beitin? So it's very possible that you would have to pay for the cost of the Shliach Beitin. I mean, yes, he is a Shliach of the Beitin, but you might still have to underwrite that Shliach Beitin, because otherwise, why should Beitin be out the money to make sure that this guy travels to the bar? Right. It's clear that the request has to come from someone for the Beitin to put a Shliach Beitin together. Shimon Elazar says that even though you made the request to Beitin, and he's functioning as the Shliach of Beitin, the Nigzal never agreed to this settlement. So Rabbi Shimon Elazar says it doesn't work. What you're saying is our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that a Shliach Beitin, since he's an independent party and he's under the auspices of Beitin, no matter who appoints him, it's done because Beitin has that power to do that. But Rabbi Shimon Elazar says that's not true. The Nigzal has to be a party to this. Without the Nigzal being a party to this, it doesn't work. Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Elazar, the Amri Tarvayu, Shliach Shasol Beidim Avi Shliach. So here you're Belozer and Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan is Talmid Chaver Rabbi Elazar. Both agree that, like Rav Chista, if you point a Shliach with Edim, he is a full-fledged Shliach. V'im tomar Mishnatenu. What about our Mishnah? Our Mishnah seems to indicate otherwise. So b'mamtzi lo Shliach. It's a case where he makes a suggestion, a friendly suggestion to send a Shliach. Tamale, it is Uzei Gabi Planyo. He lives in a far-flung place. And he says, listen, I have a debtor out there, or I have this Gazlan out there who owes me money, and you happen to be traveling to that place. When you get there, identify yourself and say, listen, I know you owe this guy money, and you haven't sent it, why don't you appear before him? Maybe he just hasn't found someone to send it with. We're far away from each other. He may not have found someone that happened to be traveling to my area. So he says, listen, you're going there anyway. While you're there, just show your face and say, listen, I'm from such and such a town. I happen to be heading back there. If you want to use me as a shliach. Now, that is not an appointment of a shliach. That's simply just saying, I'm available to act as your agent. But that means that the Nigzal never gives approval or never appoints him as a full-fledged shliach. The appointment of agency happens from the Gazlan side. The Nigzal just happens to make a suggestion to appear. And that's what it means, shlucho. Shlucho of the Nigzal, it's not really that it's his shliach. He's just someone who is associated with the nigzal, but the actual agency is created by the gazlan inami. The other answer is k'rav chista b'schirov l'kito. That's the other way to answer, is that he's a shliach not because he was appointed through edim, but rather because he is associated with the nigzal, and therefore that's why he's considered to be a shliach or an obvious agent, but he still wasn't appointed through edim. So that's another way to answer in our Mishnah how you have a case of shliach, but a shliach that doesn't have full-fledged responsibility and is not deemed as be as if the nigzal received it. Either, again, that he's a self-evident shliach, so there's no edim appointment, or because of the case that he really just sent him as, I'm making it available to you, look, here's your opportunity to send the money, but not that he took any responsibility with regards to the money. I'm Rabbi Yehuda Meshmuel. Ein mishalchi ma'ot b'diyupnei va'afilu edim chatumim aleha. So here you have a case where the guy comes with a document evidencing the fact that he is an agent of the party. Diukne, we see it sometimes like demut diuk, no, which means that the shape or the nature of his face. That is here, diukne means his seal. It comes with a document that has the nigzal or the creditor's seal on it. So it's clear that he was appointed by the nigzal, or he's appointed by the creditor. Not only that, there are edim signed at the bottom that say that this is the seal, this is the signature of this individual. So therefore, what you have here is the equivalent of a limited power of attorney that says that I'm functioning in place of this party. He's got the evidence, he's got everything there that shows that he is the shliach. Nevertheless, they say, Ein mishalchin ma'ot. You can't send money with this person. I mean, you can send money with this person. It just doesn't change the fact that you're responsible for the money until it reaches the nigzal or until it reaches the creditor. You're on the hook for the money. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, im edim chatumim alei mishalchin. If there are edim signed on him, what else do you want him to do? I mean, he has a power of eternity. Why wouldn't you send the money with him? It looks like he's acting as an agent for the principal, and it's as if he's accepting the money immediately. So here it's clear, Rabbi Yochanan's position is easy to understand. Shmuel's position is much harder to understand, and that's why the Gemara asks now, Amrei l'Shmuel, my takanta. According to Shmuel, how do you ever have a proxy or an agent that is functioning in shlucho shel adam kemoto, as if he is the nigzal, as if he is the creditor, and it's deemed as if you gave the money back? Here you have everything you would want, a power of attorney, signed by Yedim, and yet that still doesn't give you the right to give the money to him and be off the hook. What else could you do? What else could you ask from the individual? Now, Tosfot over here says the deficit here in this document is one of two possibilities. One possibility is that the deficit in the document is the fact that the edim signed on the seal. They didn't sign on the shlichut, they signed on the seal. So it's not a shliachut that was made with edim, it was a shlichut that was made through the seal. The edim signed that the seal is the seal of this individual, or the signature is the signature of this individual. So therefore, they're not testifying about the shlichut itself, they're just testifying that the signature of the creditor or the nigzal is his signature. So that's one possibility as to what the deficit is over here, that's what Tosafot says. Therefore, based on that, if the edim signed on the shlichut itself, even Shmuel would agree that that's good. That's one possibility Tosafot says. The other possibility Tosafot says is, similar to what he answered on the previous amud, is that it has to be befanav. The only time a proxy becomes a full-fledged proxy with edim is when it's done in front of the debtor, or it's when it's done in front of the gazlan. Over here, since it was done far away, even if the edim signed on the document, signed on the shlichut, it would still not work because it wasn't done in front of the gazlan or the debtor. And that's the deficit over here. So for one of those two reasons, Tosfot thinks there's a deficit here in the power of attorney. The question is, for Shmuel, how do you ever send money back with a shliach? So the answer is, Gihad Rabbi Abba. The case of Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Maske Zuzeb, the Rabbi Yosef Barchama. He was a creditor to Rabbi Yosef Barchama, and we've seen Rabbi Yosef Barchama before. He's the father of Rava, and we know that Rava, his son, becomes a greater Talmud Chacham than his father, and many times he gives advice to his father or corrects his father in halachic matters. And here's a case like that. So Amalei Rav Safra Ba'adid Da'atit Aitinu Ni'ali. So Rabbi Abba says to Rav Safra, you happen to be going over there to Rav Yosef Barchama's house. Can you bring back the money for me? You know, act as my shliach to bring back the money. Kiyazul da'atam, when Rav Safra gets there, Amalei Rava Bray, Rava, Rav Yosef Barchama's son, intercedes in the transaction. He says, Mikatav lecha hitkabalti. Did Rabbi Abba write for you, Rav Safra, hitkabalti? It's as if I received it. Meaning that Rava wants to know that once they hand the money over to Rav Safra, they're off the hook. So he says, I want a receipt that says that you received the money, and it's as if Rabbi Abba got the money back. Amalei lo. Says, no, I don't have that. Says, Yochi, Zilberesha, come back another time. V'chtob lecha hitkabalti. And have him write out a receipt that says that it's deemed as if accepted. Libisova Marley. Then he shows up again and he has the hitkabalti. Ikatav lecha nami hitkabalti. Even if he writes you a receipt that says I received it, lav klumhu. That's not enough. Dilma ad atit. Before you come back, shochiv Rabbi Abba. Rabbi Abba will pass away. V'naflo zuze kameyatme. And then the money will belong to the yitomim. V'hitkabalti the Rabbi Abba lav klumhu. And then the receipt from Rabbi Abba is meaningless. Yeah. He wants to protect himself. He doesn't want to be on the hook for the money on the way. Because otherwise, he's got responsibility until it reaches back there. So here, there are two possibilities of what could happen over here. One possibility is that Rabbi Abba is alive. As long as Rabbi Abba is alive, then the agent, Rabbi Safra, is a full-fledged agent. And he's acting on behalf of Rabbi Abba. Therefore, if he gets a receipt that says, hitkabalti, I'm done. Everything is good. On the other hand, the problem is, if Rabbi Abba passes away, then the agency breaks apart. I mean, there's no longer an agency. The principal's gone. The agent is no longer an agent of Rabbi Abba. Who owns the money now? It is the Yorshim. The Yitomim are now the creditors to Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama. The problem is that the creditors now never wrote Hitkabalnu, that we got it. The Shliach that's going to collect the money, they never appointed. So he's not their agent. And we don't have a receipt from them. So he's afraid now that if the agency is abrogated because of the fact that Rabbi Abba died, then you have a problem now that the people who are now the creditors never gave permission for this Shliach Rav Safra to act on their behalf, as well as the fact that they never wrote Hitkabalti. So he says, I need to know that you are going to accept full responsibility. So what he wants Rav Safra to do is become personally liable for the money and say, Rav Safra, either I want a receipt from Rabbi Abba that it's as if collected, and I also want you to take personal responsibility for the money. Therefore, if the agency breaks at any point, you are personally liable and not me. You'll take it up with the Yitomim, not me, because you are personally liable for the money. So what do we do to solve this problem? Zil nikninu lecha gavaro. You're going to acquire it, or you're going to become the possessor of the money through a kinyan agav. And then you write to us that you received the money. What he wants him to do is he wants Rav Safra to become the full-fledged owner of the money. He wants Rav Safra to become personally liable. How does he do that? Well, you can't make a kinyan on money unless you do a kinyan mishicha. Unless you do it. That doesn't exist here because we're talking about a debt that is outstanding. So how do you transfer the ownership of the money to this individual? You do what's kinyan agav. That's Gemara in Kiddushin. That agav karka, you've been konem mitaltalim. So what he does is he gives him a plot of, or piece of land. He gives him some acquisition in the land. And through that acquisition in the land, he also takes possession of the money. By doing that, then Rav Safra becomes personally liable for whatever it is. And now, Rav Yosef Bar Chama is off the hook. He handed the money to Rav Safra. I'm done. You take it up with Rav Safra. Now the whole diyun is between Rav Safra and whoever the creditor is, whether it's Rabbi Abba or whether it is his children if he passed away. In either case, it's between you and Rav Safra. We're not in the picture anymore. Rabbi Abba is going to give Rav Safra ownership over the loan so that his receipt is a full-fledged receipt. So when Rabbi Abba gives Rav Safra full ownership over the loan, now when Rav Safra gives a receipt that says it was collected, we don't have to worry anymore. Rav Safra's standing in front of us. He said, I collected it. We're off the hook. Now, Rav Safra has to take it back and give it to Rabbi Abba or his children. That's between you and Rabbi Safra, but we want to be out of the picture. We want to know that when we hand over the money, we are done, and that we have no more responsibility. And so that's what Rova was trying to do, was protect his father from having to pay the money, and then all of a sudden something happens in the agency, something happens with the money, and all of a sudden he has to pay again. So Rava was just ensuring that his father was fully protected. And so this is what he demands. He demands that Rav Safra be appointed in such a manner by which his saying that I accepted the money or I received the money would close the case as far as Rav Yosef Bar Chama is concerned. So now, in terms of the land here, Tosfot over here discusses something which comes up in a number of scenarios throughout Shas, which is that certain transactions require land. So that's fine as long as someone is a landowner. What happens if the person's not a landowner? How do we generate such a proxy agency with out land? And how do you then substitute or compensate for the fact that he doesn't have karka? So what we say is that instead of him having karka, you grant him karka. You give him some karka in order to do it. Right, so that assumes that the other party is also a landowner. In the end, Tosafot says something here, which is very interesting. It's interesting only because Rabbeinu Tam says it in the Gemara in Ketubot as well, which is that if he declares that he has land, and he basically says, I'm granting you the land with which to accept the ownership of the money, we don't go and question whether he has land or not. Right. If he admits to the fact that he has land, and he declares he has land, then we assume that that is good enough. The Rabbeinu Tam invokes this principle with regards to ketubah. He says that a ketubah is based on the fact that the chatan comes here, he wants to get married, he's promising all this money to his future bride, and then he says, you know what, it's backed up by the land that I own. And that means that there's underlying assets by which are protecting the ketubah that's here. Right. Now, that is true, as long as he has assets at that time, that's true. Even if he sells those assets, buys new assets, then the lien will just move from one thing to the next. But if at the time of the marriage he has no assets, and he only acquires the assets after that fact, then there was no lien on those assets. No lien ever existed because he had no money or assets when he entered into the ketubah. So the Rabbeinu Tam says, I don't understand. All of our chatanim are penniless. They're getting married. They own nothing. So now they make these they make all these promises in the ketubah. What is backing up the promise in the ketubah? He doesn't have land. He doesn't have any nechassim. What he acquires in the future, the lien doesn't exist on. It only exists on present assets. Now, that lien can be transferred from the present assets to new assets. But you have to have something on which the lien is coming to hold. So the Rabbeinu Tam says the same thing over there, which is, when the chatan tells us that he has nechassim and he has land, we don't question whether he does or doesn't. We just assume he has the land. And therefore, he puts himself, where basically what he says is, hodak baldin kamei edim dami. When someone admits to having something, we assume that it's true, and we accept it. Therefore, if he gets assets in the future, we just assume whatever assets he had now, he turned into these assets, or the lien moved over. We don't question, we don't look too carefully to figure it out. Tosafot makes the same statement over here with regards to karka. If it's someone without land, you could generate the same scenario or situation over here, which the person just says, listen, with the land that I have over here, I want you to acquire it. He doesn't have land. We don't ask anything. He says that he has land. We just assume that there is a Kinyan Agav over here, even though there is no land that is there, or he doesn't necessarily own the land. So it's an important nuance in this idea of owning land in certain circumstances as to how you get around that problem or compensate for the problem if people do not have land. The truth is, it's really not important to us that you have land. It's important to us because we need to generate a lien, or here we need to generate a Kinyan. So what's important to us is that you basically indicate that you have the land, therefore you can create this Kinyan Agav, or you can create a Harsha'a, you can do certain things. It's a fiction, but the fiction's enough to generate the lien or to have a lien take effect, because you're basically obligating yourself. In this case, the Chatan is obligating himself that future assets now will have a lien on it because he thinks there's a land now. We don't mind you obligating yourself. We don't mind you creating additional obligations. So now, Kiyad Rapapa, similar to the story of Rapapa, of a Mesik Tresar Alfei Zuzei Bechuzai. He was a creditor for 12,000 zuz with Bechuzai. Akniu Niale the Rav Shmuel Ba'aba, Agav Asif de Beite. He gave it over, or handed it over to Rav Shmuel Ba'aba, based on a Kinyan Agav, Asif de Beite. Rashi writes two possibilities, that Asif de Beite means either the threshold of the house, or Sefer Beite means some place at the end of his house, some location. Rashi over here, he says, I gave him dalad dalad amot. The truth is, you don't need 4x4 amot. You need any amount of karka. It doesn't have to be a specific size of karka. You just need any karka. And he was going to him, Kiata, when Rav Shmuel Ba'aba came back with the money, Nafak the Ape ad Tavach. You can see in Rashi, there's two vavs in the word. He spells it that way, so that's probably the pronunciation is ad Tavach. Sounds like here that he went out to greet him. Rashi claims he went out to greet him because he was so happy that he got the money back, that he had collected this loan. It was a lot of money that he had outstanding as credit with these individuals. And so he was thanking Rav Shmuel Ba'aba for actually getting the money back and bringing it back to him. The other possibility is that he went out to greet Rav Shmuel Ba'aba because, remember, he handed over creditor rights to Rav Shmuel Bar Abba. Rav Shmuel Bar Abba really owns the money now. He really is the owner. So what he wanted to do was intercept him before he actually got back to the location where the land was, and then the Kenyan would have finalized Rav Shmuel Bar Abba. He wanted the money back with him instead of Rav Shmuel Bar Abba keeping the money. So he went out to greet him to ensure that he got his money back instead of it staying with Rav Shmuel Bar Abba. But either way, you see the way that he generated the agency in order to have the collection work was that he did it agav karka. He did it through land. And that would be Shmuel's solution, where he says that simply having a signed power of attorney is not sufficient. And even according to the Tosafot, that means even if the creditor himself wrote in his own handwriting, or it's clear that he made this guy an agent, it still doesn't work. And therefore, the only vehicle to ensure that you are protected is what Rava suggested to his father over here, is to make sure that the agent is empowered to write you a shover, to write you a receipt that says that he received the money, and you're off the hook because he is so empowered that he's basically the creditor now, the shliach, and therefore you're off the hook. And that's what Rav Papa did, and that's the case by Rava and Rav Yosef Bar Chama. All right. In our Mishnah, it says that if he already repaid the Karen, but not the Chomesh, he does not have to search after the guy or chase after the guy to pay the Chomesh back no matter where he is. Alma, from that you would conclude, Chomesh Memonahu. The fact that you would have a Havamina, that the Chomesh has to be returned directly to the individual, shows you that the Chomesh has a status of money and not of a Knas. The Pasuk says, Lasher Lo Yitnenu, that you have to get it back directly to that individual. That's only true with regards to the monetary aspects over here. So if it was a Karen and a Chomesh, the Karen was money, the Chomesh was a Knas, or was deemed to be like a Knas, then that statement would only be true about the Mamon, not about the Chomesh. The fact that we now have a Havamina, that the Chomesh also would have to be returned directly to the individual, shows you that the Chomesh is also Mamona. That's one way to learn it. The other possibility to learn it out, we'll see in a second, the Gemara, is the fact that you can take a shvuah on the Chomesh. If you return the Karen, and then you have the Chomesh, and you take a shvuah denying the fact that you owe the Chomesh, then you pay a Chomesh on the Chomesh. That shows you that the Chomesh becomes a monetary obligation, and therefore you can generate another problem of a sham gzelot if you take a false shvuah with regards to the Chomesh. So, v'im mait, mishamele yoshim. And if he dies, then the Yoshim have to pay it. If it is a Knas, then a penalty or a Knas is only obligation of the party themselves. If it's a monetary obligations pass to the Yoshim. Because basically the person who's owed the money has a lien here on the assets. As long as there are assets that exist, then the individual can come and claim against the Yoshim. If it's a Knas is something that is outside the realm of monetary obligations. It's a penalty. We only penalize the individual who did the infraction or was the problem. We don't penalize the Yoshim who were not the individuals who did it. It's not Nami. And similarly, our Mishnah says, Natan et Karen v'nishbala Chomesh, that if he gave him the Karen and then takes a Shvuah denying the Chomesh, Harei Mosif Chomesh al Chomesh. Alma Chumsha Mamonahu. Again, that's what I said before. This is the additional proof that the Chomesh is Mamon. Either because of the fact that we would have said he has to return it directly to the individual had the Mishnah not told us otherwise, or because of the fact that he can take a shvuah on it, deny it, and then be chayav. V'tanya nami ochim, we have a braita that says a similar thing, gozelet chaveiro v'nishbalo, person who stole from his friend and then took a shvuah denying it, umeit, and then he passed away. Yoshim mishalmim karen v'chomesh. Yoshim paid both the karen and the chomesh, upturim min hasham. They're patur min yasham gzelot because yasham is brought for kapara. Kapara is only helpful when the person's alive. Once they passed away, their death is the kapara. You don't bring a korban after someone has passed away to bring them kapara. So as far as yasham gzelot is concerned, the yoshim are off the hook because bringing it now is meaningless. The person who needed to bring it has already passed away. But as far as the Karen and the Chomesh, they are on the hook for it. Yoshim b'nei shlumei chum shadavun avo? Wait a minute. Are the Yoshim really payers of the Chomesh of their father? Now the Gemara is going to challenge that. But what the Gemara has assumed until now is, since the Chomesh is Mamon, they are on the hook for it, just like they're on hook for the Karen that they owe. So that's the establishment. That's what we think until now. Now the Gemara is going to challenge that and say, wait a minute, are Yoshim really on the hook for the Chomesh of their father? Viriminu. We have a Tosefta that says, Adayin and Yomer, Eimatai enu mishalem Chomesh al gezel aviv. When is the case that he does not pay for the chomesh for his father's theft? Bizman shelo nishba lohu v'lo aviv. It's a case where neither he nor his father took a shvuah. So we know in a case where neither his father nor he took a shvuah, clearly don't have to pay a chomesh. That's obvious because nobody took a false shvuah over here. How do we know in a case v'hu v'lo aviv that he took the false shvuah? I mean the oresh took the false shvuah, not his father. Aviv lohu, or his father took the shvuah, not him. Hu v'aviv, they both took a false shvuah, minayin. How do I know there that you don't pay the chomesh? Tamaloma asher gazal v'asher ashak. The one who stole, the one who withheld the wages or withheld the payment. V'hu lo gazal v'lo ashak. And the son is not the one who stole, and he's not the one who withheld the wages. So since the son is not the party to the problem, meaning that he wasn't the one who generated the problem, therefore he doesn't pay the chomesh. That's irrespective of who took a shvuah. In one of the scenarios here, the Braita says that the father took a shvuah. The father took a false shvuah and he's now chayev a chomesh, yet the son doesn't have to pay it. That's against what we just said. We just said Yerushim are on the hook for a chomesh. Over here we're saying no, they're not on the hook for a chomesh because of the fact that they were not the gazlan, they were not the one who was a sheik. So Amar Rav Nachman lo kasha, kasha hodeh, kasha lo hodeh. Depends on whether the father admitted to saying it falsely or not falsely. If he admits to the fact that he took a false shvuah, that already obligates the parties now and the monies. Once the obligation is there, the Yerushim are also obligated. In the case where he does not admit it, then there's no obligation. No obligation, the Yerushim are not on the hook for it. But a problem with that is, little problem with that is, ilo hode, if he didn't admit to it, Karen nami lo mishalev. Then why are you paying the Karen? Fine, you're right. You don't pay a chomesh, but you're also not going to pay a Karen. Meaning that the father never admitted to lying under oath. If he never admits to it, what claim does the nigzal have over here? What claim does the creditor have over here? The debtor never admits to the fact that he was on the hook for this money. If he doesn't not on the hook for the money, forget about paying a chomesh, you don't even have to pay the Karen. Once he doesn't admit, there's no obligation. Forget about it for a chomesh, there's no obligation to pay the Karen. So if you say here, you know what? He doesn't have to pay the Karen. Our case here, or what we're saying in our Gemara is that the Yerushim have to pay the Chomesh. Okay, now you're saying, no, he doesn't have to pay the Chomesh. Implicit in that is that everybody agrees the Karen gets paid. So you can't say, no, yeah, you're right. You know, he doesn't pay the Karen, doesn't pay the Chomesh. No, that's not the situation. That's not the discussion in the Gemara. The discussion here is simply about whether you pay the Chomesh or not. Assuming that the Karen is definitely getting paid. Va'od Tanya, and we have an additional bright similar to the bright that we just saw before. It's a continuation. Karen al gezel aviv. When do you pay for the Karen when his father was the thief? Bahu v'aviv. The case where he and his father both took a false shvuah, there it's clear that you have to give back the Karen because they both lied. Aviv v'lohu. What happens if his father took the false shvuah and not him? Hu v'lo aviv. He took the false shvuah, not his father. Lohu v'lo aviv, neither of them took a false shvuah minayin. Tamalomar gzela v'oshik aveidau pikadon. That you have to return whatever doesn't belong to you. Meaning that there's an obligation to return irrespective of the shvuah. The shvuah is not what generates the obligation to return the money. What obligates you to return the money is the fact that it was stolen. The fact that it belongs to someone else. So the Karen, in terms of the Karen, that obligation exists irrespective of the shvuah, and that obligation is there, even though the father was the thief, the father was the one who caused the problem, there's an obligation for the Karen. And therefore, Yesh Talmud, it's a cryptic statement here about Yesh Talmud, which seems to be, okay, so we have a limud here, we have something now that explains to us that the Karen is an obligation that exists independent of the shvuah, independent of the father, and the chomesh is something that does not exist. The obligation for a chomesh doesn't exist. That's what you would conclude from this braita, which is that your shim are responsible to repay the Karen. They are not responsible to repay the chomesh. Now, v'yotiv Ravuna, v'kamala shmaitita, Ravuna was saying over these braita, all of this that we're learning in the Gemara, amalei rabu brei, yesh talmud kamar, mar? Rebbe, my father, what did you just say here? What does yesh talmud mean? Oh, yesh talmud kamar, mar. What did you mean by Yesh Talmud? Now, I don't know if he misheard him and he was asking him to clarify, or he didn't understand what the words Yesh Talmud meant, just like it's hard for us to understand what they mean. So he says, Yesh Talmud, Rashi describes that the two tzadim are this. Tana mikra maitila meftiv kol hani ribu yehu sheben chayav l'shalem. O Yesh Talmud kamar mar umisbaruhu m'shalem v'lo mikrai. When you brought this proof, the fact that the Yorish has to pay for the Karen, Were you bringing it from the fact that the psukim specifically are numerous in number, or the items are numerous in number, and therefore there's a ribui here that you have to pay back the keren of the father, and it's a gzeirat ha-katuv that the yoresh pays, or, I mean, I won't call it gzeirat ha-katuv, but it's out of the psukim that he has to pay it back, or are you just simply saying logically, if it was stolen, he has to pay it back. Why should he be able to keep money that it was stolen? Why does he have to keep items that don't belong to him? So he's asking him, which one is it that you're making a statement over here? Are you saying it's a pasuk, midoraita, or are you saying that it's a logical argument? I'm saying that, no. I'm saying here it means that we have a limud from the psukim that teaches you that the yorshim are on the hook for the keren. So now we're in a bind. We have said now, until now, that chomesh is mamona. Chomesh is mamona and the yorshim are on the hook for it. So we had a problem from the Braita that the Chomesh, you don't have to pay back when you're a Yoresh. Rav Nachman jumped in to solve the problem and says, oh, it's a difference between whether the father admitted to stealing or didn't admit to stealing. We bring another continuation of the Tosefta and it says, that's not the case. Even in the case where the father does not make the admission or even doesn't take a Shavuah, you're still on the hook to return that which was stolen or the Keren because it's a stolen item. It's something that you are obligated to give back. It creates a problem for Rav Nachman, because in a case where he doesn't admit, so we said if he doesn't admit, then why are you chay for the Karen? Why are you chay for the Chomesh? The Gemara says, okay, maybe you'll say that he's not chay for anything. No, we have a bright that explicitly says you are chayav for the Karen. So now how do we reconcile Rav Nachman's answer in order to solve this problem? When is the Yoresh chayav Chomesh or not? So the Gemara says now, Amrei. We're going to say the situation is here. Elamai lo hodeh. What does it mean that he didn't admit to it? Lo hodeh aviv, vodeh bino. The father didn't admit that there was a theft here or there was a problem here, but the son did admit to it. So therefore, the keren you pay, because the son has admitted that he has stolen items in his hand, but as far as the chomesh is concerned, the son is not responsible to pay a chomesh for that which his father did, or which his father stole. Where it says, v'nechayev b'no chomesh ashvua didei. Wait a minute, why don't you then obligate the ben on his shvua? And the fact that he took a shvua here. Remember, the cases in the Braita involved cases even when the son took a shvua. So if the son took a shvua, forget about the chomesh for the father. There should be a chomesh because the son denied it through a shvua. Where it says, Amrei b'she'ena gzela kayemet. The gzela is no longer extant. When he took the shvua denying it, the gzela was no longer around. Right? If the gzela is not kayemet, and therefore the children are under no obligation to return the item, then if he makes a denial, even a denial under oath, Rashi says here, it's a shvuat bitui. It's not a shvuah that's going to obligate him in a keren chomesh. It's just simply a shvuah because he is under no obligation to pay. Not under any obligation to pay. When you deny, your denial is not a denial of the payment, but it is a improper statement, an improper shvuah, but not connected to the denial of a payment, and therefore you won't be chayav keren chomesh and the nasham. Where it says, ibishen gzela kayemet, Afilu Karen Nami lo mishaleim. If it's no longer extant, then why is he giving back the money? We're going to learn this in the upcoming parak. But when it comes to the return of an object that was stolen, if the object is a discrete object, we saw this actually before in the Gemara, then it's l'kvod aviv, you return it. Because otherwise the people are going to come along and say, ah, look at that stolen cow, it's still there, and it's going to be a problem for the father. So we demand that the children return the object because the object has a shame gneva or gzela on it, and we say return it. If that item has already disappeared and has been monetized, there's no obligation on the yorshim to return the money that was stolen, only to return discrete objects that were stolen. So Gemara says, lo, tzricha de'ikach rayut. It's a case here where even though they've monetized it and the object no longer exists, there was achrayut, meaning that since the obligation was generated prior to the father's death, it was a stolen object, thief has a claim against the assets or the estate of the gazlan. Since there is property here, he can go after those achrayut nechasim, which is he can go after those real property because he has a lien on the real property because of the fact that he was stolen from. When he's stolen from, he has a right of collection against the original gazlan. The original gazlan, when he dies and passes that real estate to his children, the lien stays with that real estate. So yes, the gazela is no longer extant, but there is land in the estate, and that land has a lien on it, so he can go after the land. Where it says, Why does that help you? If there's a chayut nechasim, why does that help you? Milva alpehi, umilva alpehi, no gover, lo mina yorshim, velo mina lekuchot. This is an oral loan. There's no documentation of the loan over here. So why is it that you can say that he has a lien on the property and he can go after the property? Liens are only generated when there is a written document documenting the debt or documenting the obligation. Then you have a full-fledged lien on the property. Because here he stole it, that's the equivalent of a milveh al-peh. That's like an oral loan. It's Amrei Bishamad Bedin. So now this is a very problematic part of the Girsa over here. Rashi says that it doesn't exist. He says you should take it out of the Girsa. Bishamad Bedin, he says, wait a minute. If he's Amad Bedin, Bishamad Bedin kodemitoto, vachamada maimahani, hare kafar v'nishba v'lohodeh. What do you mean? We just established the case that the father didn't admit to doing anything wrong. So what Hamad al-Bedin do you have over here? What does it mean they went to Beit Din? Beit Din? Beit Din is not invoked here because the guy never admitted to do anything wrong. Therefore, Rashi eliminates it from the Girsa and says that you should continue like this. Iachi Chomesh Nami Mishalim. If that's the case, then you should also have to pay for the Chomesh. Meaning that if Chomesh is money and the obligation stems from the original Gzela, then not only should he have a lien for the Keren, he should also have a lien for the Chomesh. Tosfot points out over here that you could maintain the Girsa of Hamad al-Bedin, even though Rashi wants to take it out, in a case where we prove that the father was lying, not because he admitted to lying, but rather Edim came. If Edim come and say that he was lying under oath, he only pays the Keren, he doesn't pay Chomesh. Chomesh only comes about when you admit to doing wrong, that we know from the Parshia of Gezla Ger in Parshat Naso, there in Perek Hay in Bamidbar, it tells us that there has to be Hoda'ah in order to obligate the Chomesh. But if Edim identify him as being a liar, then he wouldn't be a Chayav Chomesh. He could have a scenario where there was Hamad al-Bedin, and yet he still was not Chayav Chomesh. And that's how Tosafot maintains the Girsa that is here. So I'm Rabbuna Breda Rabbi Yeshua, Lefi She'en Mishalmim Chomesh Al Kfirat Shibud Karkaot. That is because the denial here for payment was a denial against the Shibud Karkaot. So let's think about this. The father never made any admission in this case. So the father is not on the hook for anything except for the fact that he stole. And that Karen now can be collected out of his assets or out of his estate. So as far as that's concerned, we're good. The son also denied the fact that this was a stolen object or something was stolen that they owed money. The son also took a shvuah. So now, as far as the son's shvuah, we said that he's not chayav a chomesh because the item is no longer extant. The item is not extant. He's taking a shvuah about something that doesn't exist anymore. That's why he doesn't pay a chomesh. The Gemara says, okay, great. But then why is he paying him back the Karen? If the item doesn't exist, there's no obligation on the Yorshim to pay back the Gzela at all. So the answer to that was, no. There's achriyut nechasim. Achriyut nechasim is that he had a lien on the property. So now when he denies the need to pay that back, he made a denial. So then the Gemara says, why doesn't he have to pay a chomesh? He's denying money that is owed to the gazlan. The money is owed to him because the lien was on the property. He comes along and makes a denial about that. The son is making a denial about an existing obligation that comes out of the estate. The lien's there and they have an obligation to fulfill the lien and to pay back the gazlan. And he's denying that fact. So now that he's denying that fact and taking a shvuah about it, he's basically a denier under oath. And now you should be chayav the Karen and the Chomesh from the son's side because of the Shibud Karkaot. That's what Rav Huna, Breid, Rav Yeshua says. Wait a minute. You're not allowed to take a shvuah on Karka. I mean, when you take a shvuah on Karka, it doesn't work. The Torah excluded Karkaot from Shvuot. It also excluded because they're like Karka itself. And therefore, he had no obligation to take a shvuah over here, or his shvuah is meaningless, which is what Rashi describes over here. When he takes a shvuah over here, he's not taking a shvuah that results in Hashem Gzelot, he's taking a shvuah bitui. Shvuah bitui is simply where you make a statement. You take a shvuah about something, and you're telling the truth or you're not telling the truth. It doesn't come with obligations of Karen V'chomesh and all that. Okay, you might be chayav and taking a false shvuah, but that false shvuah doesn't generate and Hashem Gzelot doesn't generate a Karen V'chomesh because you have under no obligation to take a Shvuah here because it's Kfirat Shibud Karkaot. Rav Amar, Hocha Mayaskinan, Rav gives a different option, which is Gon Shaita Diskia Shalavgi Mufkede B'yad Acherim. There was some sort of sack that had this money of his father with someone else. Karen Mishalem Da'ite. The Karen he pays because the money is available. Chomesh lo mishalem, tichi ishtaba, bekushta ishtaba. When he took the shvuah, denying the fact that his father had any money to pay this back with, he didn't know about this money. In that sack of money is this stolen money. So they find the stolen money or the stolen object, and therefore he's going to have to pay it back because now we know that it's there, but he had no idea when he took the shvuah that that was the case. So then the son takes a shvuah to that effect that we have no money or we can't pay you. After the fact, we find out that there's this huge bag of money that was kept that the father had that could pay back whatever the obligations were that he didn't know about, the son didn't know about. So now again, once again, his shvuah, when he takes the shvuah over here, is meaningless in terms of a shvuah that would generate Karen V'chomesh or Hashem Gzilot, because his shvuah, and as Rashi says over here, in chayavin al shigiga, you're not chayav on a shogeg in terms of a shvuah, because when you took the shvuah, you didn't know. You had no idea about this information. Maybe he should have known. Maybe he should have found out. When he took the shvuah, he thought he was taking a true shvuah. He wasn't lying under oath. And so therefore, in this case, he has to have some sort of zadon. There has to be some sort of intent to do wrong when you take the shvuah. You have to know either that you owe the money, you have to know that the shvuah is false. Here he does none of that information, and therefore he's complete shogeg. That shvuah will not obligate him in a chomesh. That's why he owes the karen, because the money is here, and in the end he has to pay it back, but he doesn't owe a chomesh because of the fact that there's no way to obligate him. His father didn't admit to it. His father didn't take a shvuah. I mean, his father took a shvuah, but never admitted to doing something wrong. He did take a shvuah, but his shvuah that was taken was under false premises, which he didn't know that there was money left over to pay back the father. And for that reason, there's no obligation of a chomesh over here, and that's how we're going to resolve the cases. There's sometimes where the yoresh is chayav a chomesh, and that is once the obligation devolves upon the father, the yorshim are on the hook for the chomesh. And there will be other scenarios where the yoresh, if he takes the shvuah and admits to it, he will be chayav for chomesh. But there are certain instances where the yoresh will not be on the hook for the chomesh, the first of which is that the father never admitted to doing anything wrong, so there's no obligation from the father. And secondarily, even if the son has an obligation for whatever reason to repay the karen because of the circumstances that we've discussed here, either because he has a lien on the property or because there was a bag of money that was left over, nevertheless, when he takes a shvuah, that won't necessarily obligate him to pay the chomesh because either it was taken about karkot or shibud karkot, which does not require a shvuah, or he took about a shvuah when he didn't know that there was this sack of money around, and therefore there's no obligation on him to pay the chomesh because he didn't take a shvuah that is deemed to be a shvuah denial that would generate the obligation of Karen V'chomesh. Okay, so we're going to stop here about the two dots in the top of Kufhei Amud Aleph.